Welcome to Climate Talk Uganda. I am Josephine Karunji. This week, we're turning our attention back to some of the questions around health, displacement of communities, and climate change. Crispus Mwemaho has a background in health services, and he's co-founder of the Abayuti Climate Action Network. The network focuses on livelihood support for climate-displaced people, policy advocacy, community engagement, and research. Crispus has also founded Kampala Climate Cafe, a hub for youth capacity building and networking in Uganda. He has a lot of things he's involved in, all centered around climate change. So when he joined me in the studio last week, I was keen to hear more. But first, I asked what inspired him to focus on the ways climate change, climate mobility, and health intersect.
When I was at uni, I stayed in the ghetto around Sao Paulo, Kagwa. And
a lot of us, I don't know, I wouldn't have called it a ghetto if yeah. I was in that area as well.
Yeah, I don't know whether you know Kakajo Zone.
Yes, I do.
It's I don't know if you don't want to call it a ghetto, I don't know what it should be, but it's a ghetto. And wherever it would rain, it would flood, and there was a lot of issues to do with, you know, waste and all that. So when we are starting, I honestly didn't also have an idea of what I'm doing and how it relates to community health. We started as people who are mobilizing the community to do plastic management, waste management, community cleanings. And when I was growing in the space, I started understanding the correlation of what I'm seeing in my community, where I was residing at that time, and my profession, and the broader term of climate change itself. And that's really, so I learned on work that actually the community health relates with climate change, and how, for instance, things like plastic, waste management have a direct impact on how we suffer from climate change and its impacts. Yeah.
So you pivoted your learnings to center around the community.
Yeah.
What have you seen in the community? Share a story with me that you've seen or encountered in the community that brings me along your journey.
So I think there are like two. One, I come from Zimbabwe. That's where my village is. And we are predominantly livestock farmers. And this area is known to be very dry. And I remember growing up, every time, every dry season, our livestock would die. And sometimes we would move to other places to look for pasture and water for our animals. But at that time, it didn't resonate, really. And then building on what I told you, coming to school, going to a clinical school, and then staying into this area, so I started collecting information when I was doing this work, when I started doing activism, because I didn't want to be just like any climate advocate that was, you know, growing at that time, where I saw most of the activists in Uganda would just, I'm sorry to say this, would just copy and paste what was the climate activism in the Western countries to bring it to, you know, Uganda. And it didn't make sense for me. You're holding, for instance, 1.5 degrees Celsius on streets of, let's say, Kampala, or even...
You're holding a placard.
Placard.
Says,
but it doesn't make sense to a border person. But if you tell them, if you mobilize them to do, let's say, cleanup, it resonates with them because this is a problem that is close to them.
If they understand
why
or what this means.
So for me, it was blending action and message. And that's how I actually learned eventually that actually the climate change itself has an impact on the things that we are seeing on the ground. And also the actions, the everyday actions, behavior, form a bigger impact on either the impacts that we face, and if we face them, the magnitude of how we face them. So to me, it was, you know, this lived experience as growing up as a child. At that time, I didn't know until I stepped into the field, and now I started, you know, knowing, oh, this is actually why
we were, animals were dying.
This is actually why we are seeing these floods. And along the way, actually now, I started to, you know, specialize. Because climate change is broad, and this is where people don't get it. You cannot be an advocate of whole climate change. You have to, you know, I'm not saying it is wrong, but it is almost impossible for you to advocate for everything on climate change.
What are you advocating for?
So right now, as I grew into the space, I blended into what I grew up seeing and why my passion and profession is. So I do advocacy on things to do with migration, environment, and climate change. And I look at displacement, forced displacement. I co-founded an organization along the journey, About Climate Action Network, and we work with climate displaced communities and other at-risk communities. So, for instance, in the ghetto, you might not be displaced today, but every time it rains, you're at risk of that temporary, you know, floods and all that. So that's what we are doing as an organization. And it feels home because now I feel like the problems or the things that I advocate for, I've lived through them. I know much about them. And I even have the experience as a profession and someone who is working directly on ground.
What did you say we should call you?
A practivist.
A practivist. All right. What does your typical day look like?
So right now, I work with my organization full time.
That's Abayuti.
Yes, Abayuti, and we work with a range of communities. We work in Kasese. We work with a camp called Muhocha, internally displaced people's camp. It is hosting exclusively people who are displaced by floods, permanently displaced. You've heard of a story of River Nyamwamba, and every time it rains, a lot of people are displaced from their communities. Now, there's this camp which is hosting over 1,500 people. And they are, in real sense, refugees in their own country. And what we do is we have various projects that we are implementing there. One being climate smart farming to ensure food security, because these people now rely on external aid in terms of, you know, food relief from the OPM, Office of Prime Minister, other humanitarian aid. But we know that with the reducing and dwindling humanitarian aid across the globe, the impacts in the camps is alarming. You know, when you go there, you smell food insecurity. People there skip meals and all that. So we are trying to support families to produce their own food. And what we do, we rent land in campus communities where now we give an opportunity for them to continue farming. But we don't just stop at that. We train them with practices that can withstand climate shocks. And I was impressed when you mentioned about your project. I was like, how best can we work together? Because ideally, this is the same thing, but we are in a different region. I don't know how possible it is. But it is an interesting project because we are working with people who have been displaced by climate change. And I can say that, you know, loudly and clear. So these are people who are displaced by climate change, and we are working with them to ensure food security through climate smart farming. And we also do skills development for green livelihoods and sustainable livelihoods. And these skills range from things like crafting. We have trained people in soap making using locally available resources, tailoring for women and girls, and other things. But we also do have an education program for displaced children. We have a pre-primary school in the camp, and we are offering free education to these kids.
This is all you?
All my organization.
Well, you and your team. Okay, your organization.
Yeah.
How long have you been in existence, this organization?
Yeah, we were established in 2020, as a group that was working in the ghetto in along Sao Paulo, Kagwa Road.
And so you went back to your university area and said, let's start from here.
So that's where we started from. At that time, we were just doing community cleaning. But at the time where floods were hitting the country left, right, and center, we interested ourselves in working with people who have been displaced by floods, given that we were from a community that experienced floods. So we knew the impacts, you know. So I remember in 2020, we went to Kasese and we are carrying humanitarian aid. We had done some fundraiser, gotten some food stuff, flour, beans.
Clothes.
I mobilized university kids, gave me clothes and all that to take to the people who have been displaced. And when we reached there, I was so shocked. We were carrying a truck of food. So in my heart, I was like, you know, at least people will be going for a week on this food because it was huge. And when we reached there, because people were many, they were only taking 2 cups of flour, you know, each family. And I was like,
this is not a week.
This is not.
It's not a day.
It's not even enough for them to carry for 2 days. So we started thinking, how best can we do sustainable projects that are not just relief, because relief can never be enough for people, you know, in these situations. And I also think that we need to redefine the kind of humanitarian aid that we do in modern era.
It has
you know.
To be sustainable.
It has to be sustainable.
It has to outlive you.
Yeah, so we started now doing, we did a community needs analysis, and people told us, you know, we have been farmers all our lives. All we need is, if we can get a chance to get land, we can then start, you know, restart our lives. And we started mobilizing funds and supporting some families to rent land in camp host communities, and they are able to till and produce food for themselves. Surplus is sold for them to continue renting the land, so which is more a bit sustainable for them, not only in terms of food, but also they are able to integrate intercrop, cash crops and food crops. So they are, at the end of the season, they are able to do some household needs and also get food. Yeah.
Tell me about a family that you've seen that this has been impactful for them.
You mean a project, right?
From your project. A family that you've engaged with and you can see that this is working.
I think all our projects have been tested and proved, to be honest. I'll give you a case study in all of the three components I mentioned, not to say that they are the only things that we are doing. But for instance, when we started a pre-primary school in the camp, our idea was that at least someone can read how to read and write their names, you know. And when we started, at least now we get sponsors who come to the camp and see kids getting education. And they are like, oh, so now after this, what are you doing? So they are able now to give them scholarships. Last year, we promoted 50 kids from our pre-primary school. And all of them were given a bursary in a neighboring school in Kasese district. But not only those, you know, we have been getting a lot of bursaries just because of this initiative. But if it wasn't there, people wouldn't notice that displaced children are not having
school.
The second component is the farming. We have, when we are doing the grouping of the people, we take an acre, 2 to 3 people, 3 families actually. And the people that we started with in 2023, for instance, right now, they are independent. They are not doing as a group. Each one of them can have managed to go and rent their own piece of land, bigger than what we started with. And for us, it's a plus, because now these people cannot just wait to have food from government, but also they can be able to have life as they used to.
This is a long way from a truck full of things,
you know,
with 2 cups of flour to now people having their own pieces of... Okay. larger pieces of land they can grow food on.
And just of recent, you mentioned the Mercedes-Benz Fellowship, where I am a fellow. They got me because of the work that we're doing. When I applied, I pitched the project that we're doing, and just I think tomorrow I'll be going to implement a project that they are funding. They're funding the expansion of this work that we are doing. So we've been working with 20 households, and now we received a project that will help us scale the number to about 70 households in the camp.
So I spoke about the Mercedes-Benz Fellowship before we started the podcast. So I want you to tell us very briefly about it. You are a Mercedes-Benz
Visionaire
Fellow 2024-2025.
Yeah.
What is that about?
So the Visionaires Fellowship is a fellowship that is supporting young people across the world in sustainability and climate action. And they are taking young people from the age of, I think, 18 to 28, and they develop them in terms of capacity building and mentorship on their projects, and also fund them. So when you finish off the year, you're given a chance to pitch your project if it is, you know, eligible for funding, and it has grown to that capacity.
Okay.
But wild enough, when for me I was starting, I'd already started, I'd been working on my projects, so it was easier for me to get into the fellowship and get, you know, mentorships from venture coaches, mentors, and also when this opportunity for the grants came, they already had seen what I'm doing and, you know, were interested in funding me. And that's how we started.
There's a lot about you. At what, 27?
28.
28 now. How are you doing all of these things in such a short period of time? You were the winner of the Future Together Award in 2022 for your outstanding work in climate refugee camps in Western Uganda. Just tell me a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, so just like I mentioned, to me, RIUT, my organization, I take the work we're doing so dear because I think in as much as small we are, I've seen big corporations and big organizations which are they're not doing as much impactful work on ground as we are doing.
And compared to their size?
Yeah, compared to their size. I in fact, one time hosted one of people that I won't mention here. And when they saw they were visiting us and I showed our different initiatives. And I remember this lady telling me, she pulled me on the side and told me, "Do you know, CRISPRs, how much money would big organization be accounting for this work that you are doing?" I said, "I don't know, but
you're not doing enough accounting."
so she was like, "I feel like for big organizations, if they had this kind of work, they would be saying millions of money they've injected." And she was wondering how have I been able to do all this work when we don't have big funding. I said, one thing, it's the will to do what we are doing. And for us, we have interested ourselves in not just being, you know, activists who are just talking. I think talking is so good, but it would also be very good if it is complemented with action. So we need to do local mobilization of funds, and we be able to implement our plans. Otherwise, they will just be on shelves for the next 5 years. And then in the next 5 years, we also do another revision and still do that. So for me, I've actually been trying to advocate for local financing from the government, such that the plans that we have, the development that we do, is resilient to climate change impacts. Otherwise, we cannot rely on external funding. It has not worked.
If money was not a problem and you had all this money at your disposal, where would be your first area to prioritize?
So if money wasn't...
In health. And thinking about the community work you're doing.
Yeah. So one thing that we should take notice is from the vulnerability impact assessment, it showed that most of our health infrastructure, our health workforce is not capacitated to, you know, respond to climate change impacts. So one, we need the infrastructure that is resilient to help to climate change impacts.
What does that mean?
It means that you're building an infrastructure that is proofed, you know, or with a very good structure in terms of strength and also planning to be able to cope up with the, let's say, floods, landslides, hailstorms, and all these other climate change impacts. You see, for instance, I'll give you an example of a health facility in Kasese where we work from. It is called Kirembe Hospital. It was demolished by floods back in 2020, you know. And this hospital was serving over 100,000 people in that district. So you can imagine, where are these people getting, you know, health services from? Yes, there have been efforts to upgrade some health centers and also downgrade the health services that were being received at that facility to other health facilities. But still, the people within that area are suffering, you know. So for me, we need climate-proofed, you know, infrastructure. We need to build the capacity of our health workforce to ensure that when, for instance, a patient comes today to a doctor, they don't just prescribe to a patient just medicine. In the health education they are giving to this patient, they need to incorporate climate education such that, because patients take what they receive from their health service providers as a very good information.
We're seeing doctors as influencers now.
You know? So imagine you went to a doctor and, for instance, if you had, let's say, malnutrition, your kid is having malnutrition, you're now being told to, you know, how do you incorporate, you know, nutritious foods in your planting, you know, and also how you can plant fruit trees in your garden such that your kids can get, you know, these fruits. So this is climate action that is being relayed from a doctor, a medical personnel, to a patient, and they will take that. So we want the health workforce to also be, to build capacity of the health workforce to respond not only to the impacts, because as I mentioned, there are areas which are, you know, hit so hard, and they are the aftermath are, for instance, mental health, and some doctors do not have a correlation between mental health and climate change. So how well will you treat these patients if you don't know the intersection between climate change and mental health, for instance?
You've taken me into so many places that I want to go and explore, especially with the refugee settlements and the internally displaced camps. Mm. Tell me a bit about the work that you do with Kampala Climate Cafe.
Yeah. So the journey to that cafe started in 2022 when I traveled to COP27. So I found many Ugandans in COP, many young people who are doing a lot of work. I am from Uganda. I don't know these people. So I was like, what can unite young people who are doing stuff in climate change to come and, you know, network, learn from each other, but even collaborate? Because sometimes we are doing same work in silos. And I believe if we could come together, we would actually collaborate, partner, and make bolder, you know,
where do
actions.
These young people who are not at COP but would be interested in the cafe find you?
Yeah, so when I came back, I was giving you like a background to the cafe. I came back, I was interested in having just a hangout where people come, and it's not really very much official. So it is, I would say, it's Gen Z friendly and not...
That disqualifies me.
No. It's just chill. So we started hosting these cafes where we would bring activists, students who are interested, even old people who are interested in the work that we are doing. And it blew up before I knew. So for me, I already thought it would be just a hangout where we are like a small group of 10, 20, 50, I don't know. And in the first call, we had like 100 people. And I was like, I don't have this capacity to hold these people. So how best can we do this? So I started engaging other partners to host this, you know, to come together. And it blew up. I'm telling you, it blew up. Actually, we had paused the cafes because we were restructuring and everything. But I'll tell you, every space I go on, I'm known because of the Climate Cafe, not the work that our UT. And I feel, you know, not good about it because, I mean, like, I've been around doing all this work. And for you, because you know me because of cafe, you think I'm just cafe. But I also get it. I get it because young people found purpose in this space. And the networks that young people made from this space, I get testimonies of them. You know, I met this person on at the cafe and we've been able to do this and this. And to me, it's you know, inspiring. It's motivating to see that we still lack that, you know, big platform where young people can come and share their ideas. In one of our recent cafes, our last cafe actually that we had an exhibition and we were very much, you know, fascinated with what we saw. Young people doing a lot of innovations in environmental sustainability, climate action. And for me, I think maybe it is also an opportunity for me to pitch. We need a bigger space for the cafe.
But you know? You're not answering my question on how listeners who are interested in what you're talking about would join this cafe, would participate.
Yes.
Where are you?
So the cafe, we have social media handles. We have, they can also directly reach out to me at the moment via my social media handles to learn more about the cafe. But we also do have the Twitter and Twitter or X. And X. I'm not informed so much. X and Instagram and also LinkedIn, where they can, you know, find us and know much more about the cafe. Yeah.
We'll put some of the details of that in the show notes.
Yeah.
What would be your parting shot for us? I know we've gone all over the place. This conversation was supposed to be heavily tagged around health, but then you have just so much experience in little pockets.
So my parting shots would be in two ways. One, to someone out there who feels that they are overwhelmed, climate change is huge, you don't know where to start. Start with where your passion lies. Your passion will drive you to do even much big things, you know, bigger things. And two is, I want to highlight the need for us to be intentional in our development as a country to ensure that whether it is works for the roads or agriculture programs, health programs, they are climate sensitive. Because right now, there's nothing that we can do and is not sensitive to climate change, because it is the reality of what we are facing at the moment. And for me, we cannot wait for the billions that we keep negotiating for. We need to start thinking, rethinking how best we can use our internal resources, our national budget, to ensure that we have meaningful climate action, especially in the communities where it is much needed.
Crispus Mwemaho, proactivist and co-founder of the Abayuti Climate Action Network. You can find a link to the network and find out more about their work by going to our show notes. And as I often say, we're always keen to hear what you think of the podcast. So if you'd like to drop us a line, you'll find us at climatetalkpod@gmail.com. Please do get in touch. And thanks for listening. I am Josephine Karunji. See you next time.